Hey guys, this is Ben with Code Career. This is our third episode of the podcast. Here with my co-host Nick and our guest Tim. So today we're going to dive a little bit deeper into Tim's background of being a developer and dig into some of his pitfalls, his struggles, and kind of determine what some of his core focuses are on, you know, where he's heading in his career. Nick, is there anything that you know, really caught your eye that interested you about Tim's story?
I just kind of I saw that you had a nice big like tweet thread on your thing at Denver Coder, I think is what it was. So I kind of was reading through that as you were messaging me, and I just think that I'm trying to think now. Like you started out like as .NET and all that fun stuff, right? But then you know that altercation type thing happened. I don't know, like if you want to talk through that whole thing, and then just kind of sum that up. I mean, in the best way possible, I guess, or like however long you want to talk about. It's all about you, man. So I think it's really interesting how, and I know you'll probably get to it, that, you know, all the, you've pretty much just been busting your ass and saying, screw my situation type thing.
So, I mean, a lot of it, you know, a lot of it, what's in the Twitter thread has already been told several times. Basically, you know, like I really like to focus on like, you know, kind of what happened after. I mean,
yeah, of course, man. So, you know, as Nick had mentioned, you started out with your .NET stack. What have you pivoted to recently? Are you still in .NET or did you pivot into like JavaScript, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so kind of interesting was that, you know, I kind of just got .NET dropped on me. In 2002 to 2003, I was basically working for my stepfather. Him and another guy, actually a friend from college, they'd known each other since college. They started a company called Safer You. And you have to remember that this was the time before the internet was what it is today. There really was no concept of a web app. It was all, you know, Windows applications. Maybe you have a website that people could like look up some data, or they could, you know, check their account or something. But for the most part, everything was done locally on each, you know, distributed user's computers. So what Safer You was about was a way to kind of document. So you could put in all of your legal information, like if you had a power of attorney, if you had a will or anything like that, you could kind of warehouse all of these important documents, you know, a deed to your house, stuff like that. You could document all that stuff. You could take pictures of your children along with, you know, their heights and weights and their fingerprints, and you could store all this information. And it was all meant to be kind of put onto a thumb drive that you could, you know, put in a bank vault or make multiple copies and store them. And the way it was set up was, you know, if something happens to you, you know, so like, let's say, you know, two parents are killed in a car accident, but the child survives, then the, you know, whoever the grandparents or, you know, godparents or whatever, they would have this thumb drive that they could go and pop into a computer and they'd be able to access all the important information they would need in case something happened. So that was the idea. And basically they dropped it in my lap and said, hey, can you build this? And, you know, I at the time was doing some QA work for their other company that they'd started called Fusion Software. And so I really didn't have a ton of developer experience, but they gave me an MSDN subscription, which back in those days was a box full of CD-ROMs, and basically said, you know, there's this new thing coming out called the .NET framework. Everybody's really excited about it. You should check it out, see if you can learn it, and then just, you know, try to start building the application. So that's kind of how I started. It was a self-taught developer before, you know, that was a big thing, really. It was everybody that I knew back then had degrees, and everybody I knew back then either learned through like an apprenticeship type deal, like almost how like trade people in trades learn, you know, where if you want to be a plumber, you go find a plumber and you would work underneath them. They would kind of teach you. There was a lot of that going around back then where, you know, they would hire people off the street basically. And but, you know, there wasn't really this concept there like there is nowadays of, you know, being able to have all these resources. I mean, there was no resources back then. Stack Overflow didn't exist yet. Experts Exchange was around, but Experts Exchange, I don't know if you remember, you had to pay for answers essentially. So it wasn't free. And when you're working, you know, on essentially a startup and you don't have access to a huge amount of capital, then that's kind of difficult to pay. You know, if I had to pay a 10 cents every time I used Google nowadays, I mean, I would probably be making minimum wage as a developer because, you know, most of my salary would go towards that. But
me too, man. Me too.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was where I got my start. And it was all just kind of, I didn't have, you know, there weren't these internet communities like there are today. There wasn't Facebook. There wasn't Twitter. There wasn't, you know, any of these places where you can meet other developers. It was just basically me in a vacuum, and I had nobody to go to for help. I didn't know any other developers. You know, wasn't like I was going to meetups every weekend or anything like that. Like, those didn't even exist. So it's kind of a weird time where it was like, I mean, imagine if you had no plumbing experience and you started a plumbing company and you lived in a town that there were no other plumbers and you had nobody to, you know, kind of mentor you or to ask questions. You just kind of had to figure everything out on your own. So
you definitely got elbows deep in shit, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it was, and I mean, ultimately we never finished the project. It was one of those things where I got a decent MVC working, and then everybody kind of lost interest in the project and moved on to other things, and never really got used. But I did build some other kind of cool things. Like a friend of mine had a tattoo parlor, and he had, like, you know, if you've ever been to a tattoo parlor, they've got thousands of these three ring binders sitting around everywhere with all their
stuff. Yeah. That they've done. Yeah, the past.
And hanging on the walls and stuff. And so I told him, I said, look, I could build you a kiosk, you know, where it would be a monitor and, you know, a PC with a keyboard and a mouse, basically. And you could start scanning in all of your artwork, and then people could actually search for stuff. You know, we scan stuff in and we put, like, meta tags on them, you know, so dragon, you know, this and that. People could search for stuff. They could find something they liked. They could actually, we had a camera, like a little web camera set up, and they could, like, you know, if they wanted to get a tattoo on their arm, they could kind of turn to the side and, like, take a picture of their arm, and then they could drag the artwork over and resize it and stuff and kind of, you know, get a see how it kind of looked. But, you know, that was basically it. And then, of course, you know, I was arrested October of 2004 and spent the next 12 years under some kind of supervision. So either jail or prison or a halfway house or parole. So funny enough, I actually did some programming in prison. There was the medium security prison that I was at first. They had this huge inventory, like, warehouse, right? And they had uniforms and bedding and different, like, you know, hygiene type stuff stored in there. And they had no idea how much of anything they had. So they actually gave me access to a computer that, you know, was not connected to the internet at all. Basically gave me access to access and created an entire inventory system and access. So
that's awesome, man.
Yeah. So
was it, like, part of the trustees program, or, like, how did that work?
No, I mean, I was always kind of trusted, I guess. I was an inmate representative for a really long time. I worked in the GED department for a really long time. So when I worked in the GED department, I had access to a computer too, but they had these special images for, like, teaching assistants and stuff. So they, you know, they had no internet access. I had access to, like, student files to see, like, what GED tests they had completed and where they were at in their road to getting a GED and stuff. So it was interesting because, I mean, almost the whole time I had access to a computer, but I didn't have access to the internet, because that was, you know, that was a big thing. That was a big no-no, is they didn't want you to have, you know, unrestricted access to the outside world, I guess. So.
Yeah, it makes sense after sending, you know, people like Kevin Mitnick through the system. Yeah, they're, like, super paranoid about him, like, whistling codes into the phone and...
Yeah.
Well, and then he launched or something.
He got out of prison and ended up going to work for IBM, I think, you know, as kind of a white hat hacker. So he got back into the industry afterwards. But I mean, I think when he was first released from prison, he wasn't even allowed to touch a computer for X amount of years or whatever. So.
Oh, that's one hell of a restriction thing.
Yeah. I don't know if I could do it. That's really tough. I mean, especially nowadays. I mean, think about it. You can't touch a computer. Like, okay, I can't go to my bank. I can't go to, you know, I mean, nowadays you go to a restaurant and sit down, they slap that little tablet thing on the table and, you know, you can order your food and pay through there. So it's like,
sometimes you can't even ring a doorbell, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Yeah, so it was interesting, and it was, it's one of those kind of things where I probably had one of the most unique experiences, just because of, you know, a series of random events kind of put me into these different positions of trust where, you know, I mean, I think I don't really come across as, you know, like a typical convict. So you kind of stand out a little bit because, you know, you're not like everybody else. You know, I wasn't like everybody else in there, just like I'm not like everybody else out here. It's just one of those things where it was a weird situation where, you know, you're in prison, but I had a lot, and I had a lot of freedom that, you know, to move around the facility and stuff that other people didn't have. So
after your experience of getting out and, you know, basically being on probation and working through the halfway house and everything, how did you start getting back into tech?
So I took college courses while I was in college, or while I was in prison. One of the stipulations of the halfway house was you're not allowed to have any type of tablet or laptop computer or anything like that, unless you were attending college. So I was like, all right, cool, you know. So I went and signed up for a class, basically had to bring them all the paperwork showing that I was enrolled, and then they allowed me to have a laptop computer. So the halfway house kind of works like you're only allowed to go out at certain times. So for most of the time, I was just kind of sitting there in the facility. So I had a lot of time to just kind of sit around and, you know, mess around on a laptop. They didn't have Wi-Fi or anything like that, so I had to actually tether to my cell phone. And you didn't get a cell phone until, like, so there was levels. Like you start out, you're level one, and then you go to level two, three, and four. And when you're level three, there are certain requirements that you have to meet. So you have to have a job. You have to not have a negative balance, because believe it or not, when I was at a halfway house, I had to pay $500 a month just for the privilege of living there. So yeah, and I mean, you think about it, I had a bed and a locker, like a little foot locker. That was what was mine. So I mean, I was not even paying for a room. The room that I was in, I got lucky again, and I was in a room that only had four other people in it. So it was basically a smaller room, but it was, you know, that some of the rooms had 16 people. So, yeah, I was paying $500 for basically a bed to sleep in. And the way it worked was if you were a couple months behind, they would give you a chance to catch up. But if you got, you know, so far behind, you could actually get sent back to prison. So it was kind of always a race to stay ahead of that. And, you know, luckily I didn't find a job right away. It took me about, I think, 2 months to find a job, but there was people that were having even more trouble. Funny enough, people seem to care a lot more about money than they care about employee security and safety. So, you know, because the nature of my crime was violent by nature, right? It was an assault charge. I had several people when I applied to positions and told them about it. They said, you know, well, we don't hire anybody that has any type of financial crime. So theft, embezzlement, anything like that. We don't hire those people, period. But we don't really care about you assaulting any of our employees. So it was one of those kind of weird situations where, you know, had I gotten in trouble for, you know, hacking or something like that, it kind of labels you as inherently untrustworthy, and it's actually harder to get a job with something like that. So there were some guys that were in there on theft, embezzlement, forgery. They had all those charges all together, and it was nearly impossible for them to, because any place that had any type of money on hand, they would not hire you. I pretty much sat there. I would tether the laptop to my phone. I had an iPhone 4S, I think, was my first cell phone out of prison, which for me, I mean, my last cell phone before I went to prison was like I think I had a Razer flip phone. So you could text, you could play some games just, you know, on the little 1-inch screen.
Yeah, you had Snake and just maybe that was about it.
Yeah, and well, this one actually was kind of fancy. The Razer phone, it had, so you could download games. I had Sprint back then. And so from Sprint, you could actually, like, I had a Price is Right game on there, and it had a bunch of the, like, Price is Right, you know, games on it. But yeah, I mean, when I got an iPhone, I was like, holy crap, this is insane. Like, the way technology had moved in those 10 years. You know, I had an iPod before I went to prison, but it was like the 80 gig iPod that was like, you know, the size of a deck of playing cards, and it was 2 inches thick, and it had like a hardware like scrolling wheel on it.
And you could hear the hard drive spinning and stuff when you're trying to load songs.
Yeah, and it would actually when the hard drive went from zero to, you know, 5400 or whatever, it would actually move a little bit on the that initial torque from the But it was a pretty big advancement in those 10, 12 years. And it's kind of, but I kind of just fell right back into it because I had access, you know, to a lot of different things. So I was working at a fast food job, was my first job. So I had quite a bit of time because they, right about this time, they weren't allowed to let us work more than 30 hours because if you worked more than 30 hours, they had to pay you health, you know, give you health benefits. So they were capping everybody's hours at like 29 hours. So I was working 29 hours. And then the rest of the time I was, you know, sitting in the halfway house. So I had plenty of time to work on stuff. So.
Cool. That was still helping you meet your monthly quotas and stuff at the halfway house though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you didn't really need a lot of money because you weren't allowed to have any money. Like we were not allowed to have more than I think $40 cash on hand at any given time. We had to basically turn our checks over to the halfway house and then they would deposit them and then credit our accounts with the money. So didn't even have my own bank account or anything to, you know, to have access to my money. So they would give me, you know, if I asked for, you know, money, they would issue me, you know, they give me $20 or $40 at a time. Meals were either, they gave us meals at the halfway house. A lot of times I just ate at the restaurant because it was more convenient and the food was a billion times better. And I mean, I didn't have a car. You weren't allowed to drive at all at the halfway house. So I pretty much hoofed it around on a bicycle for 9 months, which was another kind of, you know, almost like set you up to fail type things, because a lot of times I would have a job interview that was, you know, 35 miles away. So it was all trying to figure out how to get there on a bike and on the bus and, you know, not having access to, because the first, I think, 6 months I was there, I didn't have a cell phone or anything. So, you know, no maps, no GPS, just trying to figure things out on your own. And it was kind of a pain in the butt, but.
Yeah, that sounds really intense.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember one time I rode my bike to work. There was about, I think, 2 feet of snow on the ground, and it was like actively snowing. And I got into work, and just me and the manager were the only ones there. And he's like, "Yeah, I don't expect anybody else to show up." But he's like, "I don't even expect any customers to show up." So we just kind of sat there in the lobby and just waited, sat around because, you know, there was too much snow to even be driving around. So
yeah, the whole like. It seems like the system sets up everybody to fail. I mean, that could be a whole another like podcast and stuff, and that kind of I haven't even had to go through that. I've been privileged and lucky enough to not do that, right? Yeah. But like, still, just hearing about that from other people, like, it actually enrages me because it feels like, okay, we need to try and like help people out as much as possible, right? And it seems like they're literally holding you back as much. And the fact that you came out of that just seems like it's a test to like your testament to like your determination to just make sure that you were like, no, I'm doing this.
Yeah, after having to work through all this, I imagine sitting behind a computer and just debugging all day probably isn't so much of a challenge.
I mean, I don't want to lie and say that I have everything figured out. It's still there's still times when I walk away from a computer and, you know, I struggle a lot with the fact that, you know, I think, oh my God, that, you know, there's just so much to learn and it's moving so fast and I'm never going to be, you know, an expert at this. And it's just, you know, there's days that I feel like quitting, you know, just completely. Just, I've told my wife a couple of times, like, one of my like secondary passions is cooking. And I just tell my wife all the time, like, you know, I'm just going to quit writing software completely. I'm going to sell my computer and then I'm just going to go like work at a restaurant and, you know, be a cook for the rest of my life. So
there's some days I come home and that's kind of my feeling too. So to be completely honest.
Yeah, I think that's a really common thread that a lot of programmers go through.
And I've talked about it before in tweets. I've, you know, trying to give people encouragement and stuff. Most of my Twitter account is, I mean, I don't do much about like, you know, hey, look at this cool tech thing I just did. A lot of mine is kind of, because for me, you know, my journey through life, I guess, is I think more valuable to people than me telling them how to declare a variable or something. So a lot of my tweets and stuff are, you know, people like will go on and they'll post something like, you know, oh, I felt like giving up today. And so a lot of my advice, you know, is just geared towards that. You know, I mean, I had one Twitter thread where I was like basically trying to nail down, you know, how difficult it is that, you know, what we're actually doing as a software developer. I mean, 99% of everything that happens is abstracted away from you. But if you think about how complex it is, right, like I've seen software systems before that, you know, a couple jobs ago, I worked on a system that was, there was one software product, but it was 22 separate repos. And there was a website a web API, Windows services, database, all these different layers. And I was just amazed that the thing even worked, you know, as well as it did. It didn't work very well, but I, looking at the code, I'm like, how does this even work at all? But I think that's part of the reason that software developers, it seems, have a little bit more imposter syndrome than other professions, because, you know, plumbing hasn't changed. I keep going back to plumbing hasn't changed much, right? In like 2000 years, you know, the stuff that the Romans were doing is pretty much the same. We don't use lead pipes for obvious reasons, but it hasn't changed a lot. So it's very possible, once you've been a plumber for 10 or 15 years, to kind of, you know, understand exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. For me, what trips me up the most is, like, you know, I don't have problems with JavaScript code or C# code. I have problems with all the magic that happens. You know, people are like, oh, you just take this component right here and drop it into your code and then just run it. It's just going to work. And I'm like, okay, well, what do you do when it doesn't work? You know, because there's like that one component that I'm using, you know, if you look at the actual like React source code, you know, there's thousands of lines of code that are making this all work, and it's all abstracted away from me. And so I think that's part of it, is that at least I don't ever fully 100% understand what I'm doing and why. So
yeah, I'm of the thing where I like to just kind of, I want to get stuff done. So yeah, I'll pull those things in. Like, I like React, I like Vue, and yeah, I like doing all these other, like, these cool tools and stuff. But also there is part of me that once I get to a certain point, it's like, okay, like, it just depends, I guess, on like how much you like the convenience, right? Yeah. And you just kind of want to say, okay, cool. Well, somebody took it away from, you know, somebody just kind of like just did it for me. But the other thing too is, I'm okay with using services like Netlify and everything because I really like them because they make my job 10 times easier. But at the same time, in my last job, and I do PHP stuff too, so I have to at least kind of know how server stuff works, right? So I kind of know how that's going on in the back, right? But yeah, you know, just it depends, I guess, on how far deep you want to go and in which particular slice of that stack you want to really dig into too, right? And
yeah, I mean, I could set up my own server, you know, to use Netlify as an example. I could mimic the functionality that Netlify gives you. It won't be as user-friendly or pretty, but, you know, I know what's happening in the background too. And I could spin up, you know, a digital ocean droplet, and I could throw Apache on there, and I could set up a, you know, a simple web server. And the fact that, you know, a lot of people that use Netlify, you know, they can drag a folder from their desktop onto the browser window, and then boom, they've got a live website, you know. So there's no real incentive to, like, kind of learn, you know, how that all works. So I think the lines between front end and back end developer are kind of starting to distance themselves a little bit, because, you know, 10 years ago, you had to set up all this stuff yourself. You know, you had to, you know, buy a computer and put it on your desk and, you know, expose it to the internet. And you had to install, you know, some kind of server, you know, whether it be Windows server or whatever, you know, and set up IIS yourself and set up an A record and, you know, open all these different ports. You had to do all that yourself. So when you were a quote unquote developer in 2002, there wasn't that term back then. There was no front end, back end development, because it was just all like, you were just a developer. And now I think it's like, as these new products roll out, like Heroku and Netlify and stuff, I think people are not everybody, you know, but a lot of people are less aware of, you know, what's happening. So.
Yeah, agreed. It's definitely, especially, I imagine, in the past, a huge challenge to have to try all these things out yourself. I mean, maybe if you got lucky, like you were saying, you would get a, you know, a CD-ROM subscription or like a book-related subscription and have to learn all these things yourself. I feel like now there's actually an overabundance of information, and a lot of people are just drowning in knowledge but not actually, you know, experiencing much.
Yeah. No, I mean, so I kind of mentor a lot of people, a lot of new people, and I don't want to necessarily use the word mentor, because, like, I'm not sitting down with them once a week and working on issues. It's just, a lot of people come to me for advice, you know, and you know, how should I proceed? What should I do next? What should I learn first? And one thing I noticed is, like, there seems to be this kind of, I call it ooh shiny, you know, and it's like, I see people that come to me and they say, you know, what I want to learn to I want to learn to be a web developer. What should I do first? You know, and I say, well, you should probably learn, you know, HTML, CSS, JavaScript in that order. And then I always give people the advice that once they, you know, whatever they decide on, if they, you know, I say, you know, try out JavaScript, try out Ruby, try out PHP, you know, try out, you know, four or five different languages, build a couple Hello World apps in each language and kind of see which one you like. But then when you finally pick one, you should stick with that one language for a year, you know, at least a year. And a lot of the reason why I push a lot of people towards JavaScript is because basically there's so much you can do with it, right? Like you can do games, you can do websites, you can do servers. You can do VR, I think, now, you know, animation. I mean, there's all kind of, you can basically do anything you want with JavaScript. So it's kind of a way for them to kind of figure out, okay, I've learned some JavaScript. Now I can kind of figure out what I want to do. Do I want to be a web developer? Do I want to be a mobile app developer? But what I see a lot of people doing is they hit the HTML and spend a day on that. They spend a week on CSS. And then it's like, they'll spend a month on JavaScript, and then they go to React, and then they go to React Native, and then they go to iOS, and then they. So it's a lot of, you know, jump. And I'm the same way. You know, I tell people all the time that I'm kind of I know a lot about a lot of different subjects, but to a very shallow level. I've gotten to the point right now where I think C# and JavaScript I know pretty deeply, not as deeply as like say, you know, Kyle Simpson or anybody like that. But I don't get confused when I look at straight JavaScript code or straight CSS code. I know what's happening, and I feel very confident with those two languages. But, you know, I do, I mean, people are sometimes like, does anybody know how to do, you know, WordPress? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I did WordPress development for 4 years. And they're like, oh, cool. Does anybody know how to do, anybody ever done any game development in JavaScript? Like, oh yeah, I've been studying Phaser for the last 2 years. I've been built a couple games, you know, so people are kind of surprised that I know all these things, but you know, it's just a very shallow layer on all of them.
Yeah. The beauty of that though, I would imagine is, you know, once you have the core problem solving skill set in a specific programming language, you can then kind of port that over to the other programming languages. You know, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, sure, you're going to have to Google a lot. Sure, you're going to have to look up a lot. But, you know, you can really adapt yourself to any new up and coming language or any new project.
Yeah. And I mean, but I think the key is that you have to know one programming language pretty intimately because. If you spend a month on JavaScript and then you move to, you know, so C# and JavaScript, the syntax is actually fairly similar to a certain degree. And a lot of times, even when my last job, I was working on Vue front end with an ASP.NET Core backend. So a lot of times it's confusing because you're looking at code and you're like, wait, oh, is this JavaScript? Oh, no, this is C#, you know, because C# has the var keyword for variables and, you know, you don't use var much in JavaScript anymore, but so it can be confusing. But, you know, if you spend a month on a language, if you go try to learn a different language, you're not really going to have that kind of depth of knowledge to pull on learning the new language. And so then, you know, to go back to our services analogies again, you know, if you apprenticed under a plumber for a month and then you apprenticed under an electrician for a month and then you apprenticed under a painter, you know, an industrial painter for a month, you know, you're going to have experience in all three, but are you going to know how to do, you know, either of those very well? Probably not. So.
Yeah, that's one of the things too, is I think even like from a framework perspective, right? We have the big three now at this point. We got like, you know, React, Vue, and Angular, and people are always like, oh, which one should I try? And I'm definitely guilty of, I've built like a couple small apps in Vue, and I've built a couple apps in React and all that fun stuff. And it's just because everybody has their opinion about what's good, and then depends on what area you're in and all that fun stuff. And it's just, it's so interesting. But there's something I kind of want to highlight here as well, is that there's two tweets inside of that tweet thread. And I got a link in the show notes that we're going to include for that entire thread. Sure. But it's pretty much, you have it pinned. So, I mean, if you really want to try, you know, it's not hard to find it, is that there's two tweets, and it says, Let's see, what was it? I want to tell each and every one of you that I'm 100% here for you with whatever you need. I promise to try my best to give some time back to others in the community. So especially if you have a checkered past and need some help, especially with finding a job, I can probably help. And mm-hmm. those two, like, you said that you're kind of like, it's not like a weekly mentor thing, but even just like the occasional, like, people come to you and you answer questions, that's still mentorship, right? And like, you're still like definitely giving a lot of value back to people. And it's, I guarantee that it's super, like, they're super appreciative of that. And I just want to say, like, thank you for even, like, not that I haven't reached out to you prior to this, but, you know, just having that option available to people and like so readily available, right?
Believe it or not, having a criminal record is a lot more common nowadays than, I think anywhere in history. You know, and the United States in particular has more incarcerated people per capita than any other country. And we're the fifth or sixth largest country in the world, population-wise. So, when you look at it like that, I think I've seen statistics as high as like 12%. Of the population in the United States have some kind of criminal record. So that means like what, one out of every five people, so there's three of us sitting here right now. My wife's in the living room and so is my daughter. So there's five people and, one of them has a criminal record, which actually holds up in this case. So I think there's two things at play. People are more willing to talk about it nowadays. It's lost a lot of its stigma. I used to always joke around that, if prison's good enough for Martha Stewart, it's good enough for me. there's a lot of these famous people that are, going to prison, going to jail, getting in trouble, doing things that we do that, that gets them in trouble. So I think it's losing some of its stigma, and, people like, there's kind of three or four people that, that I follow on Twitter that, have criminal records and have been open about it. But there's probably 20 or 30 other people that have DM'd me that, don't want to necessarily, be 100% open with everybody about it yet, but that also have criminal records. So I think there's this kind of thing where one of the biggest issues with having a criminal record is the fact that it's kind of sticks with you for your whole life, right? Like, it's one of the only mistakes that you can make that you can't like 100% get rid of. I mean, sure, people can have their records expunged and stuff like that if it's a nonviolent crime. But I mean, that takes a lot of time and it's not a guarantee that it'll even happen. So, but I think a lot of it has to do with companies, right? Because companies are a lot more willing to, especially in the tech industry, because, people in tech, I think, are kind of, outsiders in a way anyways. We're all nerds, right? We're all I'd say the majority are introverts, and the majority of us like to be inside, on a computer at least part of the day. I'm sure companies, when they first started, building websites and web apps and they started hiring developers, it was kind of a culture shock, because one thing that always kind of struck me was, I'm at a company and, 90% of the employees are like, outdoorsy people, like, oh, what did you do last weekend? Oh, I went and climbed Yosemite to the top and then I skydived off. And you're like, what? Like, I don't even like being like two floors up in a building, And so I think there was maybe this culture shock where it was like, these tech people are different, there's a lot of memes out there, and I don't know if you guys remember like the old Saturday Night Live sketch with the your company's computer guy. I think it was Jimmy Fallon, and he's move.
I've seen that. Yeah, between that and the IT crowd over in the UK.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, so we're all always kind of seen as outcasts, and so I think it's the criminal record thing is not a step too far. It's like, well, we already have this guy that dresses in like all black clothes and comes to work at 3 p.m. and stays until 4 o'clock in the morning, so it's not that much to say, well, let's go give this guy a shot, because they have a criminal past or something. So for me, you know, I mean, everybody kind of has a group that they sort of identify with, you know, somebody who has a particular disease, they may want to help other people that have the same disease or stuff like that. So for me, you know, my people, if you will, I guess, are people that have criminal records or another group that has trouble with employment is like people that have trouble with depression and they can't hold down a job because, you know, they, you know, sometimes they just can't get out of bed. And so a lot of employers aren't going to let you just, you know, miss a week because you just don't feel like going in. So.
Yeah, that's something that I've struggled with myself in the past. You know, I didn't really seek treatment, I think, until like 2015 for a depression. But yeah, it's definitely made holding down a job difficult. Luckily, now everything's kind of smoothed out.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it's the same kind of group of people, right? Because, you know, there's a stigma around mental illness as well. That's getting better, I think. And I think people are more understanding. You know, we have more access to information. So I think, like, for me, another thing is, you know, nobody in my family had ever been arrested before, you know. And my stepdad, he was a police officer. His sister is a police officer. His mother works for the NSA, and his father was an attorney. So, you know, and my mom had never been in trouble. My dad has never been in trouble. My biological father. So I was pretty much the first person in our family to end up in prison. And what's kind of weird about that is like our attitudes as a family towards incarcerated people changed, right? Because I used to be the same way myself, you know, where I'd be like, you know, if somebody came and asked for a job where I was working at and I found out that they had a criminal record, I'd be like, whoa, you know, I don't know if we want to do that. And, but, you know, I mean, my mom, you know, now that she has a son who is a felon, you know, she's not as kind of, you know, I guess sheltered or whatever as she was before. And our whole family basically has come to accept it. You know, they all know that it was kind of out of character for me. So, so much so, I think, well, this is kind of a funny story, but when my mom called my grandmother to tell her that I was going to prison, she actually told my mom, you know, oh, I think you're in shock. And you mean you're, you know, his brother. So my brother, he has like kind of a temper issue and he's, you know, had severe depression for a while. So my grandmother kept trying to correct my mom saying, you know, no, you're not talking about Tim. You're talking about his brother. And she's like, no, I'm talking about Tim. And she's like, no, you're in shock. You know, you don't know what you're saying. So because it was so out of character for me. So.
Yeah. It's a shame that, the legal system can throw, you know, historically, you know, fantastic people and, you know, people that continue to be, you know, within a positive character and a positive influence on society into the ringer like that and give them so much time. It's a shame they don't put on balance, you know, all of these other factors that go into it.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that is a product of, I mean, the criminal justice system, and I don't want to get into this too far because it's highly opinionated, but the criminal justice system is not standard, right? I mean, every state has their own rules and regulations. To give you an example, I'm from Seattle, and Washington State actually has a really, really cool sentencing guideline where what they do is they basically have like they have a graph, right, or a chart, and along the y-axis, it has the crime, and along the x-axis, it has how many times you've committed that crime. So it's kind of like when you're finding Cartesian coordinates on a plane, you know, and you go, okay, y is 3 and x is -2, and then you kind of drag your fingers together to a point, and you say, okay, that point is this coordinate and on this plane. It's kind of the same way, right? So, you know, you've been arrested for assault. It's your first assault charge. I'm going to put my finger on assault, and I'm going to put my finger on 1, and then I'm going to bring them up together, and okay, it's 2 years, you know, and then your next assault, right? So we go, okay, assault, and then that's the second time. So then you're going to come up to a point and it's going to say, you know, 6 years or whatever. So, and the reason that's cool is it's very fair, right? It's, you know, somebody who commits a crime for the first time is not going to get the maximum sentence possible. Whereas in Colorado, they have something called minimum or mandatory sentence guidelines. Mm-hmm. So for an assault charge, there's a sentence range, and that sentence range is where you have to fall under. You know, it doesn't matter if it's your first time, your 12th time, your 300th time. You're going to fall somewhere in that sentence range, right? So for my particular crime, it was 10 to 16 years. So I knew going in, like when I pled guilty to it and I went to my sentencing hearing, I knew for sure, 100% sure that I was going to prison for at least 10 years. And like I said, I don't think that having these guidelines where there's really no mitigating circumstances that can make you fall outside of that guideline, right? Like you can't say like, you know, say maybe you were doing something good, right? Like you saw somebody attacking somebody else and you ran over to help and you ended up, you know, beating the person to death or something, you know, they could potentially charge you with something. And, you know, even though you were kind of doing the right thing, and you're going to have to be sentenced within that guideline. So maybe not a perfect example, but I mean, you kind of get that, how it works. And
it's two polar opposites, right? You have the more fair, and then the more like you, let's give you a reason why you should not do these things. Like kind of, I want to say like the fear-ish like aspect of it too. Right. That's
yeah.
Colorado one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, so one thing I saw that was kind of funny was the sentencing guidelines for drug related offenses are a lot lower, and so much so that I think maybe it's not even enough of a kick in the pants, you know? So for me, my incarceration did a few things. I quit smoking cigarettes. That probably extended my life by 10 or 15 years. So I'm going to get this time back on the back end, I guess you could say. I quit drinking. I got help for a lot of my depression and my, you know, just my issues in general. I saw a therapist for weekly for almost a year. So I was basically able to fix myself because, you know, a really long sentence will just break you completely, right? But what I see is, like, I'm not even kidding. There was a guy, I was at this minimum security prison for 4 years, and there was a guy that came back 6 times in the 4 years that I was there, you know, so he got a drug charge. He got a year sentence in prison. He came to prison, you know, with good time, you only do about a third of your sentence. So, you know, 4 months after he got there, he was released. And then he got another drug charge and he got a 2-year sentence this time. And then he came back. And I mean, this guy kept getting out, coming back. So, I mean, it's not a big enough like kick in the pants, you know, because I mean, being taken away from your friends and family for 4 months and then being dropped right back where you started, that's, you know, and I'm not saying that drug offenders should be given, you know, long sentences. It's just, it's not a big enough bottom to, kind of pull yourself out of that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not enough time, I would imagine, to sit and reflect on, you know, what's happened.
Yeah. Cause I mean, you know, giving somebody with a drug offense 5 years probation where they're strictly supervised, you know, like weekly drug tests, they have to hold a job. They have to, I mean, for the most part, that is harder than spending 4 months in prison, because the 4 months in prison, you're just kind of sitting around doing nothing, right? But when I was on parole, I had to do drug tests weekly, and I had to go to my therapy sessions weekly, and I had to do all this stuff. And it was one of those things where, you know, if you give a drug offender a 5-year sentence, deferred to probation, and if they mess up, then they know they're going to go to prison for 5 years. You know, it's like you have to kind of help them in the community, because, you know, the 3-month sentence in jail or prison is not enough to kind of, you know, like the saying is, you know, somebody who's addicted to drugs, like they have to hit bottom before and want help on their own before you can actually help them. And so, I mean, I saw multiple people come back several times while I was there.
Yeah, that's rough. You know, I heard over in I can't remember what country in Europe, but I heard that they're more so trying to approach it drug use from, instead of a criminal slant, more of a kind of a mental health slant. And yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, a country taking a totally different approach to it, saying, hey, look, you know, these people probably had really bad lives and they need help with, you know, counseling and that sort of thing. But we shouldn't throw them in prison just for using drugs.
Yeah, I mean, so the, you know, people are excused from crimes all the time for mental illness, right? And because, you know, if your mind is the problem, I mean, I always go back to the movie, The Beautiful Mind, right, with Russell Crowe. I'm sure you guys have both seen it, hopefully. But in A Beautiful Mind, right, he's like, how do you use your mind to do the right thing if your mind is the problem in the first place, right? So with mental illness and with drug use, like that's kind of, you know, you're waging a war with your own self, right? So, you know, if drugs weren't addictive, then it wouldn't be an issue because you could just stop at any time. You know, and, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, I went snowboarding one time and I didn't really care for it. Like I've been a skier for a really long time. But I went snowboarding once and I didn't like it and I just didn't ever do it again, you know? And, but if snowboarding was addictive to where like, you know, it changed the fundamental, makeup of your brain chemistry and like you had this urge to go snowboarding, you know, even though you hated it, you know, it would be really weird because there'd be a lot of people that were snowboarding that hated snowboarding. But, you know, you get my point. Like, it's kind of like, there's your brain chemistry has been changed to a point where you're almost out of control of it. So,
especially when it comes to drugs and stuff like that. And aside, I have actually not seen that movie, but I do love Russell Crowe, so I need to. I've had plenty of time to see it, so that's on me. But that stuff alters your brain, like especially like if it's something that you kind of like either fall into because of bad circumstances and stuff, then yeah, that really screws you up. And like trying to approach things from more of like a hey, let's yes, there needs to be some sort of punishment because you did something like bad in theory, yeah. Right? Like depending on the crime, obviously. Like I mean, if you went and you know you ended up going and pulling like a Ted Bundy or something, then yeah, okay, then there's no help for you, right? But if you do end up doing something, even like the small drug charges or you know like a first time assault or something, right? Like I feel like we need to start approaching that as a more let's try and help people not do that again and understand the circumstances as opposed to like scare tactics. But
and see like what merit are people actually doing for society around them? You know, are they holding down a solid job? Are they helping people in their local community? Are they doing this? Are they doing that? I mean, it's baffling that they don't take any of that into account. You know, it's just, here's the crime, here's the time. You know, that's it.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, it's one of those things where, you know, there should be circumstances that mitigate, you know, a sentence, you know, so, you know, if I came home and somebody was attacking my 4-year-old daughter, right? I mean, I'm going to hurt that person. Yeah. And, you know, and so, but, you know, that's one of those situations where they do kind of mitigate that because, you know, like he was literally out of his mind for this 30 seconds when he attacked this person that was attacking his daughter. So it's, you know, if there's mitigating circumstances for stuff like that, I mean, they should be taking the entire, you know, the entire thing into account when they sentence you. And part of the problem is it takes the sentencing out of the hands of the judge, right? That's what the judge is there for. The judge doesn't try the case. The judge supervises the case. The prosecutor and the defense try the case. And then the judge is supposed to be completely impartial throughout the entire trial. And then when it comes to sentencing, the judge is the one that's supposed to determine, you know, what he or she feels is fair, right? I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen the, I think it's called Something in Providence, but it's about a judge. He's like a traffic and small crimes judge up in Rhode Island, I think. And he comes up with these really like, you know, kind of like, so the one example was the guy, he had like a $50 parking ticket and he was going to the VA and there wasn't enough parking for people going to the VA. And I guess he was maybe like 2 minutes outside of like the time that you're allowed to park there, and he got a ticket. So the judge like dismissed the ticket, but then he told him he had to take his son out for breakfast, you know, a really nice breakfast or something. So, but he tries to be fair with his, you know, sentences, and whether or not he's going to hand the fine down or if he's going to, you know, dismiss the ticket or whatever. But so, but yeah, when you take when you take the judge's hands out of making the determination for sentencing, that's I think where a lot of the problem is.
Yeah, agreed. Oh, and I just looked it up. I think it's caught in Providence.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. 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 I mean, the guy is an amazing judge, because he's, you know, he listens to them. He gives them a chance to explain what, you know, why they think they shouldn't pay the ticket. And a lot of them have, you know, really good reasons. And he, I mean, I, from what I've seen, he throws a lot more of them out than he actually gives them. But
yeah, right on. So to pivot away a little bit from,
sure,
you know, some of your past there, what are you currently focused on? What are you excited about in tech at the moment?
So I recently just left my job. I was working at the largest food production company in the world. And basically, they were doing all internal applications. So they did their own accounting, they did their own order management, they did their own even like absence management, you know, so tracking time off and stuff like that. They did everything, almost everything that they used was an internal app. So there's 45, 50 developers, you know, a lot of them were SAP developers, but I was working on a Vue and .NET project that was like a new order management system. But I mean, I liked the company and I liked working there, but it just kind of wasn't really doing it for me, right? Because I'm a little more extroverted than your average developer, and I like interacting with users. I like interacting with clients, and I like kind of being on a smaller project, on a smaller team and stuff like that. And though it was kind of a weird dynamic, because you're doing all internal application, like we had no external applications whatsoever. So our end users were our, you know, our fellow coworkers. So that was kind of an interesting dynamic, because normally your customers, if they're mad about some software change that you made, they can't come and find you and yell at you for it. But at this company, you'd have somebody walk by your desk and say, you know, hey, you need to change that back, because, you know, we're totally not able to do our jobs, and I hate you, and I don't want you to sit at my table at lunch anymore or something. So I was kind of looking for something that, you know, A, was a little bit more fulfilling, and B, something that kind of allowed me to, you know, move a little quicker and stuff. So I recently just started working at a company called Fabulous. So it's actually a startup, a small startup, but it's in the kind of legal tech. So I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I do have a little bit more knowledge of the legal system than I guess your average person. I actually, you know, through my time, you know, going to court, being incarcerated, and then getting out and going through parole. And then interestingly, I sat on a criminal jury. It was about 2 months ago, but here in Colorado, I got a jury summons. I went to jury duty. They selected me. So I sat for an entire week, for a criminal case, which I didn't know that you could do with a felony, but apparently you can. In Colorado, if you can vote, you can be on a jury. So
that's fantastic.
So, I mean, but this company is, you know, it's a small company. I think there's 5 or 6 employees. I started out working on a React project that was in the legal sector, moved on to a Vue project that's in the legal sector. So, there's a lot of stuff happening right now around, you know, the kind of the marriage between tech and machine learning and legal stuff, right? Because I guess I've never been an attorney, but I could assume that one of the hardest things is kind of, you know, if you don't know about it, then you don't know about it, right? So if you're trying a case and you need to find a case that's similar to that case to be able to see what the outcome of that case was or whatever, you kind of just have to go off of knowledge, you know, something you read about. You can go and do some kind of weak searches where you can search for similar cases or whatever. But a lot of companies are starting to use, you know, some AI and machine learning to kind of catalog this stuff so that, you know, attorneys' jobs are easier and they can kind of better do their job, right? Because you don't want to pay an attorney $300 an hour to be doing Google searches trying to, you know, find these other, you know, cases. You want to be able to have them doing the actual preparing for cases and stuff. So
absolutely. I think it's fantastic that machine learning is really getting into that space. You know, I was dating someone who is working, I forget the name of the company, but they're based out of New York and they're really focused on cancer research. And things they're using machine learning for was determining similarities between, you know, tumors and different cancer patient cases. So it's an interesting application, and it's great to see that it's being extended to the legal system.
Yeah, I mean, you know, finding that common denominator, right? You know, like you've got 200 people with a particular type of cancer. If you can figure out what they have in common, right, then, you know, you can better treat that. You know, if you can find a gene that all 200 of those people have in common, then you can develop some kind of drug or whatever that can counteract that. But yeah, and I don't know if you remember, not sure how old you guys are, but back in the day, they had like the what was it called? So they had SETI at Home, which was you could sign up, you could, you know, install this software on your computer, and while your CPU was idle, it was essentially, it would go and grab this packet from the SETI project, and it would analyze that packet looking for, you know, strange signals and stuff. And they eventually started using the same process to do genome processing, I think in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with the genome processing.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, machine learning, I mean, I wouldn't call that machine learning necessarily, but distributed computing, I guess, is really interesting because it's a way that you can kind of, you know, what's the largest computer on the planet? It's the entire, you know, internet, I guess, so.
Yeah, you know, I'm really surprised there hasn't been more of a distributed computing model for, like, mobile devices.
You think about it. Sorry. You know, your phone sits in your pocket, you know, most of the day. It could be processing, crunching, you know, something.
Oh, but it already is. Things show up in my Google search all the time from conversations that I have with my friends. So, yeah. I mean, it's being utilized. It's just in different ways. Now, there's definitely some really cool stuff that can be done with that a lot, especially like the legal stuff. Yeah, like because that's a benefit to everybody, that people get their case like figured out quicker. And then the attorneys and all this stuff can also like kind of loop back a little bit, like they can also like get more clients through. So,
yeah, exactly. And I mean, a lot of these lawsuits, you know, they're, you know, you'll have a lawsuit where some people that used a particular medical device, so you have maybe 200,000 people that have used this device, and you're starting a lawsuit against the company, and you have to figure out, because the statute of limitations is different in every state, so you have to kind of figure out, like, you know, can this person be a part of this lawsuit, or are they not eligible, I guess you could say. And so the guy that actually started this company, Michael Edelman, he's on Twitter too. He's an attorney. He's also probably one of the, you know, more talented developers that I've had the pleasure to work with. Very, very, very smart, very savvy on all the, he's pretty much a full stack developer. But yeah, so he I guess developed this Python script that could go through in just a couple of seconds, right, and determine whether, you know, who could be a part of this pool and who couldn't. So he kind of got into tech, you know, and learned on his own, started the company, and I've been working there for about a month now, I think. So, and it's going really good.
Awesome. Yeah, glad to hear it, man. So I imagine you enjoy the startup life a lot more than, you know, like a larger, more structured company.
I get bored easily. So the fact that I can work on, you know, different projects and it kind of changes that for me is, and I mean, like what we were talking about before, you know, my shallow knowledge across, you know, I think the only technology that I have not touched in my entire career is Python. And I'm actually doing some Python stuff right now. So my journey to touch every language is complete, I think. So
I noticed that a little bit. I was looking through your GitHub for a quick second. And I noticed that you had a bunch of different repos with like a bunch of different setups and stuff. So one of them being like your general Mac OS dev setup. And yeah. I noticed that Python, Ruby, and Node and stuff. And I'm like, oh, wow, you have like almost, you're getting pretty close to 1,000 forks on that. So that's pretty cool. So yeah, it seems like I'm pretty sure like what you're saving those for yourself and everybody else just finds them useful for the most part.
Yeah, I didn't know that somebody had forked any of my repos, but I think maybe it's a fork of me forking someone else's stuff. I did create like a really small, I call it simplest starter ever. And it was, you know, when I start these new projects, you know, there's like the CLIs that you have for Vue and React, but when I'm not doing a full-blown React app, like I just need to do like a simple Node app. And I want to have, you know, I want to have hot reloading and I want to have, you know, Babel and I want to have this and that. So I created my own little, I guess, like starter image, I guess you could say. And I put it up on NPM and I'm like, that way I can just use the, you know, I can do NPM or I can do simplest starter ever and then, you know, name the new project and just spin it up, right? And to my surprise, I saw the other day that it's got over 1,000, I think it had 1,000 downloads or whatever. So, on NPM. So I was like, whoa, like, you know, there's people that are possibly using this, you know, out there. And I always thought that was kind of cool about the internet. You know, when I was learning, iOS development, for me, the biggest struggle with iOS development was not writing the code. It was getting the damn thing on the App Store. This was before I discovered Fastlane. So I was basically, you know, provisioning profiles and, you know, your keys to sign your packages and doing all that stuff and then uploading it, getting it through the review process. Like that for me was the toughest part of iOS development. So I did like 7 really, really small, really, really stupid iOS apps and I put them all up on the App Store. Just to get that experience. And one day I like logged in and found out that my 7 apps had been downloaded, and not just downloaded, but installed, I guess you could say 20,000 times.
Wow.
So yeah, it's like, holy, like there's this huge spike and it happened. I must've gotten like onto one of the like featured pages or something in the App Store because yeah, I went from like 0 to like, in 1 month, I had like 20,000 installs and then it went back down. So, but I think I made a total, some of my apps have ads in them. So I think I made a total of like $10. So it was kind of weird, but it was just one of those things that, you can do these, you can contribute to much larger projects sometimes without even knowing it, I guess. And, that's what's kind of cool about the, how it works nowadays.
Yeah. It's wicked, man. Are there any like major open source projects that you've been interested in contributing to?
I mean, not really. Part of the company that I work for now, we have a couple of projects that are open source, so I'll have a lot more opportunity to do that. Unfortunately, my entire career since after I got released from prison has been for companies that had extremely proprietary, you know, stuff. So stuff with it, like, you know, I can't even like really like talk about it, you know, so
I know, man.
and so everything I've ever done is behind a paywall. And so it's like people go, hey, you know, let's see some cool projects you've done. And I'm like, oh, well, just sign up for this service, pay $8,000 a month, and then you can go in and look at it and see how awesome it is. And so, you know, so most of my career has been that way, you know, and then even to the extreme of my last job at JBS, where you have to be an employee of the company to try out my software. So, and some of the stuff that I've done is still there, but I can't show it to anybody because you actually literally have to be on the network to even look at any of that stuff. So with this new job, you know, I'm basically, like I said, we have like an open source version. I haven't spent any time working on it as of yet, but we have an open source version of a particular product, and then we have like the premium version or whatever, so the full version.
Right.
So
I had a couple of those projects in my last place where everything was in network because, you know, we ran the servers, it was our code base and all that fun stuff, so it's just nobody else needed that unless they wanted to pay us money dollars.
Yeah,
it's a bit rough to try and be like, oh well, I managed this thing but I can't actually show you how it worked. So
Yeah, and so a lot of times I find myself having to just go off my GitHub repo and, you know, like, here's some projects that I've done that I think are cool. And I think my coolest project I've ever worked on was one of the first projects I ever did completely on my own, right, with no help, very minimal, you know, borrowing code and Googling and stuff. I think one of the only things that I borrowed was the cron job part of it, but I'm a big fan of the XKCD comics.
I did notice you had a couple of those XKCD repos up there.
Yeah, so those are the ones. So the problem with the XKCD API is that you have two options, basically. You can get a specific comic. So I can request, you know, comic 413. Or you can get the most recent comic by just passing a zero. So... you know, you can go to the link, and then, you know, a query string of zero will give you the most recent comic, and then a query string of some number will give you that comic. Now, he puts out three of them a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And at the time when I built this, he had about 1,800 comics total. So what I was going to do is, as a part of an iOS learning project, I was going to build an iOS app that was like an XKCD reader, right? And the problem is that if the API only allows you to get individual comics, then if I wanted to populate the app with all of the comics, or even if I paginated it, right, like if I got 100 of them at a time, I had to make 100 network calls, you know, because you had to make a network call, request comic 1, and request comic 2, and then comic 3, comic 4, comic 5. And I was like, wow, that's just horrible, right? Because they're not big, but most of them do include an image. So it's, you know, an image link, I guess, at least anyways. So I decided that I was just going to build my own API. Randall, his name's Randall Monroe. He's really good about letting people just kind of use his stuff, you know what I mean? And I wasn't really, I was just basically trying to create a new API. So what I did was I created an ASP.NET, I guess like a service, and it would basically just go and on the first run, it would go and grab every single comic and store it into a SQL database. And then I set up a cron job so that every night at midnight, it would just go check and get the latest comic and then pull that one in. So then I had like a much more robust API, so you could get comics within a specific range. You could get all the comics. You could get, you know, just one of the comics. You could do some simple searches. So you could search for keywords and stuff like that. And unfortunately I did all of that. I had a Microsoft BizSpark account. So I was getting like, I think $1,500 of free Azure every month. And when that expired, all of my stuff on there just, you know, went with it. So,
oh man, that's rough. But I mean, that's a really cool problem to kind of solve. As you were talking that through, I'm like, oh well, you could do it this way. And, oh hey, you did. Do you know?
The funniest part is I got everything working, and then I was testing it out by just grabbing the first 10 comics because I didn't want this thing to run, you know, for 20 minutes when I was doing the initial seed of the database. So I set it up so that I could just basically wipe the database, grab the first 10 comics, and then it would just run from there, and I could do testing against it, right? So once I was very confident that everything was working and I had worked out all these bugs, I said, okay, I'm going to turn it loose. I'm going to pull down every single comic. And so I ran it, and I went to the bathroom, and I came back, and there was an error. And I was like, you know, what the heck? So I just figured that it was some kind of quirk, and I deleted the database and I ran it again, and it aired out again, and it aired out on Comic 404. So, and I'm pretty sure you can see where this is going. So I was like, what? So I ran it again, and it stopped on Comic 404 again. So I was like, okay. So I went to XKCD. I typed in, you know, XKCD/404, and it's a freaking 404 page. So Russell Monroe in his comic genius, his comic 404 is a 404.
That is absolutely beautiful.
I wasn't expecting that, right? So I didn't really account for it. Like there wasn't a lot of error handling that went into it. So I wasn't saying, you know, if you get a 200 back, then store this in the database. I was just basically saying, give me everything. And so it would cycle through all the comics, and it was getting them all. And then it got to comic 404, and it was getting a 404 returned from his API. So it was throwing an error and failing. So. Yeah.
One of those things that I don't feel like I wouldn't even be mad. Like I'd be like, oh, wait, okay, never mind.
No, I wasn't mad.
Yeah.
It was one of those shake your fist kind of moments, though. I was like, you.
Yeah. Damn it, gods, why?
Yeah. And if 404s weren't like as ubiquitous as they, you know, everybody knows what a 404 is, you know, like even non-developers are like, they're so used to seeing that 404. I mean, but think if it had been like a 413 or something, I probably wouldn't have made that connection right away. So it might have taken me even longer. I mean, it only took me like 5 minutes to figure out what was happening, because I was like, why is it stopping every single time on comic 404? And then I went to the URL and like, oh, that's why. But I mean, so yeah, it was one of those things with typical XKCD, right?
Yep.
Oh yeah. Well, I think we're getting pretty close to kind of time. I know you have a hard cutoff here coming up soonish. So I was there anything in particular that you really kind of wanted to like get out there with that we didn't really touch on yet, or
I mean,
anything you want to promote?
No, I don't want to promote anything, but you know, like just kind of like to get out there that you know, I'm always open on Twitter to help people out, and you know, anybody who does have just having problems finding a job in general, right? I mean, doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a criminal record or anything, but you know, I know people that get extremely nervous you know, during interviews, and so they freeze up and they can't talk, they can't remember anything. So I'm always here to help if anybody needs it. And yeah.
And that's what, at Denver Coder on Twitter, and then denvercoder.com, right?
Yep. Yep. Cool. And then my GitHub is pretty much anywhere Denver Coder Online is. And the interesting thing is I actually came up with the name before I even discovered the XKCD comic. So it's not the other way around, because there is an XKCD comic where he mentions Denver Coder 9. And I get a lot of questions. People ask me like, oh, did you come up with your name from that? Like, no, I didn't even know about XKCD. It's just that trying to find a domain name these days is really, really hard. And I noticed that pretty much Denver anything was available, right? So Denver skier, Denver snowboarder, Denver cook, Denver chef. Like anything with Denver was available. And I'm like, okay, well, I live in Denver. I'm a coder. Boom, put them together. And then I learned about the comic, like, I think a year or two after that. So, but I've had the domain for, I don't know. The only Denver coder account that I don't own is Instagram. There's actually a, she's in Denver, but she has the username Denver Coder. And believe it or not, she was actually, because I was going to ask her, like, you know, is there any way I can get this, you know, from you? Because it's, you know, it's basically my brand and everything. But she actually created that account about a year before I even got out of prison. So, you know.
Well, maybe you could still buy it from her.
Yeah, or maybe someday she'll come after all my stuff. Who knows?
Nah, hopefully not. Well, cool, man. You know, I appreciate you sitting down with us. I just, I have a few rapid fire questions I kind of wanted to throw your way.
Yeah.
Kind of a newer format that I'm trying out. So in the past, I would say year, what's the best thing that you've purchased for $100 or less?
$100 or less. I'm probably my hyperdrive. If you're not familiar, it's like a, so I got my first Mac that had just USB-C ports, and or my first MacBook Pro. So it's a little dongle that it kind of like, it has two USB-C ports and you plug it in to the side and it's the same color. It's that space gray color. But it has an HDMI port on the back. It's got two USB 3.0 on the side. It's got a SD card slot. So yeah, that thing is really cool.
Yeah, that looks legit, man. I just pulled up a pic of it.
Yeah, and I think it was $89.99, so it just barely falls under there. But yeah, HyperDrive 6-in-1 USB-C hub. Yeah, they're pretty cool. Really? Get the one that has the two prongs though, because the one that has one prong is kind of it's not very stable in the slot. So they make one that has one USB-C that just goes into one, you know, one slot. And the other one has the two prongs that go in. So
yeah, that makes sense. It would probably really weigh on the port as well.
Yeah. Cause it's offset. So the it's kind of, you know, it's closer to one end than the other end. So if you set it down on something soft, like a bed or a couch, it can kind of push up on it and tweak that a little bit. So.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So let's see. Also, if you had a billboard and could write anything on it for the world to see, what would you write on there?
Probably write like, "You matter."
I love that.
That's super. Yeah.
Just like, you know, have you ever seen the cans of food, like the generic cans of food at the store where it's like, it's just a white label with black letters and it says like peas, you know, like there's no branding or anything on it. It just those two words, black and white.
Very zen. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Cool. That's all I have for now. Nick, is there anything else that you wanted to ask before we wrap up?
No, I think we got to kind of everything that I was thinking about.
Well, right on. You know, thank you so much for your time, Tim. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Cool. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Code Career. If you want to see anything that we're doing, codecareer.io. Also that on Twitter, the Discord community. And we got some cool projects coming up. So stay tuned for that.